This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Better Places with me, Nathan Parsad-Wyatt.
Sidhu Dwyer.
And Oscar Harmon.
We're back for, I think, the fourth episode of 2024. Yeah. And we've had some really interesting guests on over the past couple of weeks. You haven't always heard from us, but you've heard from Jace Tyrrell, Chief Executive of Opportunity London, talking about some of the investment and economic opportunities that face the capital. And we also had on the political side Anne Clark, who is the London Assembly member for Barnet and Camden. So really interesting range of guests with more to come. Who's on the show today, Oscar?
We are delighted to be joined by Councillor Sean Davies. Sean is the leader of Telford and Wrekin Council since 2016 over in the West Midlands and is Labour's parliamentary candidate for Telford. Really interesting discussion, actually, which you'll be able to listen to following this. We discuss lots of things, but particularly the challenges facing local government. Sean was elected in 2011, so really has experienced the full decade plus of experience in local government, as well as infrastructure planning reform, housing, the upcoming election, and his role as Labour's parliamentary candidate.
Very good chat to come then. Right, this is the podcast where we talk about business, planning, politics. And so, to kick it off with a bit of politics, Oscar did want to record this ages ago, but I'm glad he didn't, because some quite big announcements have come from the Labour Party this week. That is namely what, guys?
Well, we no longer have a commitment we cannot afford.
And, well, that's a good way of putting it. 28 billion quid, that pledge that was sort of watered down a couple of times since its original announcement by Rachel Reeves a couple of years ago now, to really power the whole green investment plan and, you know, sort of almost a Bidenomics approach, really. Let's invest in the technologies, green technologies of the future, and that's something worth investing in. But obviously, Labour have decided that the need to be fiscally responsible and to balance the books is more important running into the election. So as of today, well, probably when you're listening to this, as of a few days ago, It's been binned. So how's it been received, guys, by the party?
It depends on what kind of people you follow on Twitter, I'd imagine. I mean, my timeline's been a mix of those who think it's either a strategic blunder or others who think that it's a sensible response to a changing economic climate. I think things are a lot more difficult than they were 2-3 years ago. We've got rising interest rates. The fiscal position of government is far more difficult than it was, and we don't know whether Labour's going to inherit a situation where they can afford £20 billion over the course of that period of time. So, in my eyes, I think it's a ruthless response to a man and a team, with Rachel Reeves and arguably Ed Miliband, whether he signed that off.
I was going to say, and this is the division that's been playing out, as I understand it, between those who think that Labour needs a big, bold, ambitious green offer to the nation, or those who think the fiscal responsibility piece is significantly more important than that. And I guess that side of the argument has won out. But I do find it quite interesting, because I think even at conference, when it was kind of watered down slightly and it was kind of a case of if we can afford it, we would do this, that kind of made sense. And I still think that what Sidhu's just said is not incompatible with that. But to get rid of it altogether, for me, the interesting thing is, how do you then do all of the other energy transition commitments that Labour are also pledging if you're not going to put a budget behind it? And I think that's the challenge, right? You talk about effectively making Britain the greenest powered nation on earth. I think it's quite difficult to do that if you're not putting some money behind it. So is this just, you know, effectively what Rishi Sunak did 6 months ago, which is say the cost of net zero is actually really expensive and we can't afford it as a nation and roll it back?
What's clear is that the party were concerned that the £28 billion figure in itself was going to be too much of a target of Conservative Party attack ads, and that the party essentially did a calculation between, as we discussed previously, not being seen as much of a progressive offer to certain voters, but also not scaring away people that are have their concerns about Labour's brand in relation to the economy and public finances. And I think that the calculation that was done was essentially that the £28 billion figure was always the headline-catching, the eye-catching part of the policy, but in many ways for the wrong reasons, because the clean energy by 2030, the making Britain a clean energy superpower, all of these things as part of the mission-driven government Kieran and the team have laid out, actually goes a bit beyond just the kind of the money on that. And of course, the right question is, how's it going to be paid for? Where's the money coming from? And those questions need to be answered. And part of the discussions have been, are you going to be confident going into every interview, every doorstep in the course of the election and being able to defend 100% your own policies without any hesitation, any concern? And on this, I think the answer bluntly came down to the fact that they weren't, and therefore it was bin.
Yeah, and I think this goes to the wider context, isn't it? Of supposedly the 8th of February today when we're recording this, by the time it goes out, it will be next week. But this was the date that apparently Keir and the team had set to finalise proposals for the manifesto. And there's some sort of team basically doing their own internal attacks against it to make sure the whole manifesto is bulletproof. I think the danger with that is that the manifesto becomes very unambitious, right? At a time where people are crying out for change, and change is very much the message.
What's the change? Is it change that would perhaps frighten voters who were already in quite dire straits financially and wouldn't necessarily want to feel or have any fears that perhaps an incoming Labour government is going to have to raise their taxes?
Yeah.
Or the fiscal position is going to be such that we simply cannot afford that? I think how I would look at this is, it's perhaps a good demonstration of political judgment here. This is going to be a very intense election campaign. We've already seen this week alone the amount of blunders that the Prime Minister has made, and whether he can operate and deal with the full pace of an election campaign when you're making £1,000 bets on primetime TV. Piers Morgan, who is known for headline-grabbing tricks, if you will. Mm-hmm. And actually, I don't think the bet, although that was quite egregious, to kind of put a bet on
Government policy,
but also shipping people to a country that...
let's not get sidetracked by immigration.
The other thing that was actually quite troubling for me in that interview was the fact that the Prime Minister effectively admitted that he failed in the NHS.
Yeah, I mean...
That's going to come up in the election.
But this is the wider political point of all this stuff, isn't it? Is, you know, like you said, the pace of an election and the pace of being in the top jobs is a lot of pressure, and clearly you're going to make mistakes, and that's why only the very best people survive it. I think the political challenge for Rishi is, you know... Can you stop making these mistakes and get through an election and actually show some credibility? The political challenge for Keir is already, you know, when you listen to focus groups and you look at polling, he's seen as somebody who changes his mind a lot. You know, said one thing to get elected and then changes his mind as he's gone through. But this kind of plays into that kind of thought process, is one way of looking at it.
I think that to a degree, I understand that. And that would have been part of the calculation that they made when they made the decision. Yeah. I think for me, this comes down to that real expectation that when people, you know, and Keir articulates this about how people have a loss of sense of trust in politicians and they make promises they can't deliver. And maybe perversely, I think actually this policy being dropped in many ways gives the manifesto a huge amount of credibility, because people can look at that and say,
absolutely,
I might not be, you know, might not have everything I want in it, but it's clear that the ruthlessness and the way in which the team have looked at it and gone, what can we deliver, and been meticulous and not promising the world, but going, what can we actually deliver given what we're going to inherit, given the nature of the international economy and markets and so forth? What can we deliver? You know, when you read a Labour Party pledge in the manifesto, or when someone with a Labour door, you know, Labour sticker knocks on your door, you know that what they say has been tested both financially and politically in terms of, is it deliverable? And the answer to that is yes. And I think that should give people a lot of confidence, as opposed to make them feel...
I would agree, but then that's fine as long as you don't then do these things when you're in government. And I think that's the point.
That would be the challenge.
You know, the point of getting a mandate and for things you want to do is so you can do them over your 5-year term of being in government. And by removing that money effectively from some of the policies that we spoke about, and, you know, people will listen to this podcast, businesses who will be very keen to have certainty on green infrastructure in, you know, frankly, a very uncertain environment in this space for the last few years. And actually, is Labour still committing to that plan to put a lot of green infrastructure in place, or are they not now because it's not funded, or are they just saying that it's not going to be funded and then they're going to do it anyway when they're in power, in which case you've got a mandate problem. So I think a lot of this stuff's going to be fleshed out throughout the election in more detail. And I guess the political calculation is been the, the figure is the figure, as you say. They'll have to outline the bits of it that they want to do as you go into the election.
I think there is cut through in terms of the perception, at least, that Keir Starmer isn't consistent in the policies that he either announces or the positions that he takes. I think we have to kind of look at this as, if an election were to take place in November, are people really going to remember this figure?
No, not pounds. Now, because it's gone.
And actually, what's a good, I think, a good reflection of party discipline, at least, and perhaps to answer your question, Nathan, about whether or not they will try to bring anything like this forward in government is, well, as of right now, I have not seen any kind of leaks or kind of pernicious attacks on the leadership for making this judgment.
No. Well, the poll lead keeps the party disciplined for sure.
Absolutely. And I think that's what is driving the Labour Party now, because we want to win.
Yeah.
We want to deliver on the commitments that we know that we can.
Yeah.
We're not going to set out five pledges that we failed on practically four of those five counts. And for us, it's a ruthless determination to change this country, but to change it in a way that people can believe in.
Yeah.
And I think that is the message that, as Oscar was saying, and in fact, you too, it's about being realistic for the public and not overselling and perhaps even over-delivering. One thing I did notice in the slight change in messaging as they were kind of progressively getting to this point was look into the private sector. And perhaps the party's approach, if they do are successful and do win at the next general election, look into the private sector to plug that hole.
A very conservative approach to managing the economy, you might say.
Quite.
Very good. All right, well, enough on that. I'm sure we'll talk loads more over the coming months about all the different ins and outs of what's happening on the election campaign. But right now, let's go to our guest.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Better Places podcast. Today we are delighted to be joined by Councillor Sean Davies. Councillor Sean has been first elected in 2011, is the leader of Telford and Wrekin Council since 2016, and is the Labour candidate to be the next MP for Telford. Sean, welcome.
Hello, good to see you.
Great to see you. Thanks so much for coming on. So as I touched on the introduction there, so you've been a councillor since 2011. That's obviously, a good 13 years now. Could you tell us a bit about your experience of local government, how it's changed during that time, what some of the big challenges and indeed opportunities are facing local government at the moment?
Yeah, well, sure. So 2011 obviously was the first year after Labour lost power. We had a coalition government. And I think the biggest issue and challenge that has faced local government since that is the period of austerity and the dramatic cuts to local authority budgets. I think what's really interesting from my perspective is if I reflect on the first half compared to my second half of my leadership membership of Telford and Wrekin Council is, although austerity was difficult, what's been even harder is the double whammy of austerity and further cuts, cost of living, obviously the uncertainty around Brexit and Ukraine, and of course the mini trust budget, but also the compounded effect of austerity from the first 5 years. So we're seeing more and more children looking for support and safeguarding concerns, more and more people in temporary accommodation and temporary housing, and the real costs of that inability to invest in preventative services is now starting to cost councils lots and lots of money up and down the country.
And I think that touches a lot on what we focus here at Consilio in relation, particularly with planning, where councils just haven't got the resources to be able to properly assess and go through planning applications, which of course has a knock-on effect, like you say, for things like housing, public realm improvements and so forth. We tend to have a predominantly London audience listening to this. So for those of us who aren't particularly familiar with Telford, could you give us an idea about where it is, what the challenges that face Telford, particularly geographically?
So most people will know Telford and Wrekin probably for the Iron Bridge and Coalbrookdale. reclaim the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. I know that other people try and claim that title as well, but we think we've got it in history. And we are just north of Birmingham, about 40 minutes from Birmingham. We're one of the fastest growing towns outside of the south east. So we build about 1,500 homes a year. We have done for the last 10 years. We're a new town, so we have new town land available for housing. And we are a business magnet for the West Midlands. So we've landed some of the largest foreign direct investment that the country's seen. And we are kind of a mixed economy between all, cars and the car sector, but also advanced manufacturing and agri-tech is where we specialise, as well as defence. I should say defence jobs is also a big source of our sector employment.
And looking at that then, so one of the challenges that we've identified through doing this podcast and through lots of the work that we do and the projects we work on is around infrastructure. And that is, of course, particularly acute outside of the M25. And, you know, we were looking recently, I mean, Keir Starmer did a speech a month or two ago where he spoke about the Lower Thames Crossing planning application as having 350,000 pages and being the longest on record. And obviously that's replicated right across the country with development consent orders and how difficult they are to get approved, whether they are, you know, massive projects like HS2 or massive projects like the Lower Thames Crossing, or indeed, you know, roundabout improvements of motorways and major thoroughfares. Do you think that Telford and Wrekin has the infrastructure in order to allow it to grow for the next decade? Or do you think that there's a massive place for massive place for national government to come in and help facilitate that growth? That you've already said, you know, 1,500 new homes a year, lots of exciting things happening, but that can really push Telford and Wrekin into the next decade.
Well, so let me answer that in two ways. The first way is to agree that we do need to have certainty, and we do need to have the ability to streamline planning processes and applications to get major infrastructure off the ground and get the country building. But as I said to you in my introduction, we're a new town, and actually we still benefit from pieces of land that were given new town consent in 1968. Mm. But I think there's a real lesson there for the next government, which is actually when you use power, planning power in that way to have sustainable growth, to put the infrastructure in place, often the infrastructure up front, and then you're able then to get on and build. And I think I'm really excited that Keir Starmer and others have kind of outlined a vision for new towns, whether they are, you know, standalone new towns or extensions to towns and cities across the country. I think that mentality is really, really important to give an area a real plan over, you know, not just a few years, but actually over a couple of decades, which means that there's a very clear understanding where the industrial units will go, where the employment land will go, where the housing will go, and where the infrastructure will go. And I think one of the biggest concerns I hear, not just here in Telford, but also across the country from speaking to council leaders, is a lot of local opposition to development isn't necessarily down to the principle of housing. It comes back to that infrastructure point, the roads, the bridges, the GP practices, the access to schools. And I think what we do need to have, if we're going to have a new decade of national renewal with Keir's mission to get us you know, to the highest sustained growth in the G7, we need certainty, we need clarity, and we need the ability to understand on a joint venture point of view where these homes are going to go, where the infrastructure is going to go, how does the state link into the private sector. Mm. And again, I just reflect on my time here in Telford and Wrekin. You know, you give organisations like the National Health Service, for example, or for that matter the police, your growth information. We're very hot on that in terms of our data. But there's a 5-10 year lag between that public sector investment and funding formulas being updated to the actual reality of what's happening on the ground.
You almost preempted my next question there. I mean, I think touching on, I personally massively agree with what you said about local opposition to housing isn't necessarily in and of itself an objection to the houses themselves, but rather a more overarching view about, you know, understand the principle for, and the need for new houses. I understand there's a real demand. You know, they might have children, grandchildren who can't get on the housing ladder and have to leave maybe places that are more rural to go to more urban centres. And actually, like you say, so often does come down to those things that in many ways are out of the, to a large degree at least, are out of the gift of the planning application and the applicant, because things like GP practices and roads and bridges, of course, they can put a level of contributions through S106 and SIL money, but actually when it comes down to it, that larger strategic thinking, the overarching, you know, 5, 10, 15 year plan for local communities and regions in the country is something that I think many people that we speak to identify as being lacking over the last 14 years, and there's a real desire to get back to that, which I think brings us quite nicely on to the next aspect of why we've invited you on, which is that you are Labour's candidate to be the next MP for Telford. So could you tell us a bit about when you've been selected, how you found the experience so far?
Yeah, so I was selected at the back end of 2023, so December 23, just before the Christmas break. So it was a stressful lead up to Christmas in many ways, but then a very nice early Christmas present to be selected here in my hometown. I've lived and worked in Telford most of my life, so it's a real genuine dream to want to go for and get selected by members in Telford. And it's a seat that's really, really interesting from my perspective. Labour lost it in 2015 very marginally. We lost it again very marginally in 2017. And then we were blown out of the water in 2019, like many other areas of the country. But we've consistently had a Labour council during that time. And actually the results that we've had as a council have been the best ever. Best ever in 2019, best ever in 2023. And we kept hold of the council in 2015 when we lost the parliamentary seat. And I think that tells you a couple of things. I think the first thing it tells you is there has been a disconnect between what Labour locally in power have been able to achieve and be able to communicate and do, and the people we've put up for that, and the national messaging, actually. Mm. And I think in 15, in places like Telford, it just did not connect. Obviously in 2017 and 2019, it didn't connect with places like Telford or lots of other places like it. But genuinely, I've got to say, I'm not just saying this because, you know, I'm on your podcast, but we're knocking and speaking to thousands of people every single month. And the conversation is very, very clear. They understand that Labour has changed. They understand that the country needs change, and they're crying out for that change. The work that I'm doing locally, which is being replicated across the country by other candidates, and I know the shadow cabinet too, is to ensure that we're not complacent and actually we're fighting for every vote. But we're also not falling into that trap that Labour too often falls into, which is to promise the world to the point where people don't believe that you're able to deliver on it. And I think the policies we're putting forward are pragmatic. They're connecting to places like Telford, very aspirational. You know, we don't have some of the issues that other parts of the country have. We don't have low housing number growth. We don't have declining high streets. We are a very ambitious and aspiring place. And I'm glad to say that Keir and Andrew and the rest of the team are starting to really connect with places like Telford, which is good news.
No, fantastic. You mentioned that obviously, you know, people watching will think that, you know, understand that Labour have changed and understand that we are no longer promising the world and are doing things in a much more deliberative, kind of cautious manner, some might say. I mean, I know the BBC regularly refer to it as, you know, carrying a Ming vase across a shiny floor, you know, trying to avoid making any sort of error or promising things that they know they can't deliver, particularly because of the reputation and the concern people may have about Labour promising things that they can't deliver. However, like we've said before in this discussion, there is one area within that Labour have been incredibly bold. And it promised a huge amount of reform. And as we identified, there is a huge level of local opposition. Even, you know, people might say that they believe we need new houses, but then to avoid using an obvious phrase, maybe not where they live. And that can be a big challenge. But yeah, like you say, I mean, Telford is an example of a site that is an area that's identified for new homes and is benefited from the new homes sparking out of the Second World War. You know, Keir Starmer and Angela Rayner promising in the next generation of new towns, 1.5 million new homes over the course of a parliament, and indeed reforming and streamlining the planning system to allow us to build the development consent orders and the infrastructure that can facilitate that. How does that go down on the door? Do you think, is there any part of you that's concerned about, you know, Telford's majority of approximately 9,000, the Tories will do their best not to lose that seat, of course. Is there any part of you that's concerned at all that might be something that people try and use as a wedge issue to wean some of Labour's votes away from them on a localised basis?
Yes, without a doubt. I can't think of a single housing development in Telford over the last 10 years where the Conservatives locally or nationally haven't opposed. But I constantly remind those people in those new homes that of that fact. But I also think it's about making sure that we don't just talk about houses, we talk about homes. Mm. And linked to that is beautiful, high standard quality of homes, but also where you live, the community that you live. So at the same time that we've built as many homes as we have in here in Telford, we've also created more local nature reserves than ever before. We've invested and upgraded more play parks to the Green Flag standard than ever before. We've protected more green spaces than ever before. And we've invested in, expanded and built more primary schools than ever before. And I think it's the combination. Mm. If you work in construction or house building, it isn't just about that the house that you build, the unit that you build. It's the home that you build, the family that you attract to buy that house or rent that house. And they live in communities. And you know, as a sector of developers, that actually people will choose to live in places which are beautiful, that have got accessibility to high-quality open and green spaces. They've got a vibrant and thriving high street or local centre. They have access to high-quality primary schools. They have access to good leisure facilities and places to go and have fun. And I think that's the type of thing we are talking about as a Labour Party. We're talking about, yes, building more homes, and we desperately need more homes. Gosh, if I saw a statistic the other day that you are more likely to live with your parents at 30 than your own children, which is just incredible. So we definitely need more homes. But we also need good, strong, safe, healthy communities as well. And that's where I think if you take what Labour are saying across the piece, that's what we're aiming to achieve.
Yeah, no, I mean, to add to that, recently there was a report that identified that one in three children born today won't own their own home or can't expect to own their own home until they're 50. And I think the combination of things, but overwhelmingly to do with the supply of homes, like you say, not just units, but, you know, good quality homes that people want to live in.
And I can just say on that stat, you know, that is huge for now. But also it's huge for the economy of the future. Mm. You know, these are the same young people that on the whole will not have access to housing, home ownership, like you say, but also would not have access to high quality pension funds, pension pots in many cases. They've got the lowest rate of wage increases for a generation. The problems that we are storing up for the short term and the medium term is obvious, but the massive structural issues in the economy in the long term, if this isn't dealt with, is massive.
Yeah. The general election, 2024, of course, massive year for elections in the UK, and the one that obviously takes everyone's attention, the most pressing one and generational defining one, is going to be, of course, the general election. Firstly, when do you think it will be? We like to ask our guests this just because we like to put them on the spot.
I keep sort of swinging between May and October. There's some small signs that it could be May. There's some little political things that are taking place, both in Parliament, and there's some things that, you know, returning officers are being told and councils are being told to get ready for. I wouldn't rule out May. I think the reality is that the Prime Minister, it might not necessarily be his absolute choice if things happen on the backbenches of his party. Yet again, the Conservatives, you know, kind of looking for their next leader whilst they've still got one. So if you see, as I think you probably will, you know, some difficult by-election results, the prospect of a difficult May local elections, you could see a May election. But also, I think if I was a betting man, I wouldn't rule out October.
Yeah, and no, like you say, we've got elections now at the moment, by-elections taking place in Wellingborough and Kingswood. And I think that there is this kind of feeling, isn't there, that there's just been so many by-elections. You know, I know parliamentary candidates that I know, you know, they think they're getting into the swing of things and starting to build momentum, lowercase m, and they're starting to really kind of drive forward a kind of campaign. And then they get told, right, pause that for a moment. You've got to go a few hundred miles over that way to help out in this really important by-election, which is just kind of like a slow drip, drip, drip of just, you know, the parliamentary arithmetic you know, on the 13th of December after the general election in 2019, and the parliamentary arithmetic potentially in 2 weeks' time just feels, you know, feels like a decade ago, even though it's only four and a bit years. And then looking ahead to the political challenge, of course, you know, 2019, the Labour Party were left in Parliament and the House of Commons in a position, you know, akin to the 1930s, the worst result we've experienced in almost 100 years. So the scale of the challenge can't be understated. Do you think we're up to it?
Yes, I do. But you are right, absolutely, to underline the scale of the challenge. It's the biggest. It would require a bigger swing than 1997. And, of course, the boundary review that the Conservatives have overseen overall is unhelpful to Labour and very helpful to the Conservatives. Mm. And I also think there's a third but often unspoken challenge for us, which is just apathy and frustration. And that isn't borne out because of a lack of policy offers or vision from us, but just a sense of people not thinking that anybody in power can change things. After a decade or more of people, you know, of stagnation in the economy, stagnation in wages, political uncertainty, political crisis after crisis, it's like, I think Keir Starmer said it at Prime Minister's Questions a few weeks ago, so like the longest episode of EastEnders that the country's ever faced.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a general sense of, amongst people on the door that I speak to, is just like, well, we want change, we want to get rid of this lot, but like, genuinely, can you change things? I think that we need to, and we are going to be kind of, through Keir's mission-led government, be very, very clear that actually we can get things done, we can get things moving, and we can improve things over time. We're going to have a decade of renewal. It's going to take, you know, a lot of energy and focus to get things right. But I think Keir is also right, which is about we need to get out of the soap drama and into the actual business of governing and in the interest of improving our country. And I think, you know, for many people, that will be a little bit more boring, particularly if you're a political geek and you like the highs and lows. But actually, just getting our politicians in Westminster to be focused on improving services so that people can rely on them when they need them, and also partnering with the private sector so the private sector have got certainty and clarity to invest and create jobs and build houses is so, so important.
Yeah. And you spoke about Keir's decade of national renewal, of which the number one mission of that is about getting Britain building again. And in doing so, helping make sure that Britain is the country that has the highest sustained growth in the G7. And what I like about when Keir makes these speeches is he speaks about the importance of all of those words. And the key one I want to pick up here is national. Keir says that he needs the buy-in and the contribution of all parts of the UK. And I'd like to ask, where do you see, both with your you know, the hat of Telford and Wrekin Council leader, and then, of course, were you to win in May, October, the Member of Parliament for Telford, where do you see Telford and Wrekin, but more broadly perhaps that part of the world, as playing its part in that decade of national renewal?
Well, look, we are in the West Midlands. We are, you know, we're the engine of the economy here across the country. And when the West Midlands does well, the country does well. And I'm absolutely convinced that that will be the case. I mean, if you look at the opportunities around all the manufacturing and the car industry and agri-tech and all the things I've spoken to about, defence jobs and so forth, it's huge. But I also think Keir is right around the word national, but he's also right around the word devolution that he talks about, getting power to give power back. Because the reality is that the old ways of doing things, you know, putting levers in desks in Whitehall does not provide housing, does not provide growth, does not provide businesses the ability to invest. So devolution, both to regional and then to local government, is so, so important, because ultimately, if you've got skin in the game, if you've got the ability to understand and see the benefits of those decisions you're making around economic growth, then of course you're more likely to roll your sleeves up and get that done. And I think those two things are going to come hand in glove in terms of that approach from Keir and the wider, hopefully, cabinet of the next Labour government.
Yeah, no, it's an uphill battle, but by everything that you've said there, and it's really interesting to hear you know, what the big issues are and talk about the things like manufacturing and the car industry and the armed forces manufacturing in the West Midlands. Then just finally to touch on you could probably touch on it already, but if you had to narrow down, you know, your your one priority, your one ask for the next government, whomever they may be, whichever political, you know, party they may be, one ask for the next government, what would it be?
So my one ask would be around certainty, clarity, and long-termism. You know, a decade of absolute focus, ruthless focus on getting the economy growing, building the homes the country needs, that partnering with the private sector, and reform and improvement of the public sector. And that comes for me around certainty, knowing what the next few years looks like, not just constant chopping and changing, a real commitment to partnering, and a real sort of sense of national mission. There is a national mission led by a Labour government, hopefully with those five missions, where everybody can get behind for the betterment of the country.
Hmm. Well, 2024 is going to be an even more eventful, perhaps, year than your 2022 Christmas that was a nice early present. Maybe if the election is in October or November, you'll have an early present for Christmas this year. Councillor Sean Davis, leader of Telford and Wrekin Council and Labour's candidate to be the next MP for Telford, thank you very much for joining us and look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you, Oscar. Thank you.